destruction and suffering for others. He decides to use his chemistry expertise to produce the highly addictive drug crystal meth. And he teams up with a former pupil who has become a drug dealer. And over the five series of this program, he's transformed from an ostensibly mild-mannered teacher, family man, to a violent drug lord whose hands are covered in blood. Initially, claiming he was only interested in providing for his wife and children after his forthcoming death, he eventually admits his true motivation is much darker. Breaking Bad is a Southern States of America colloquialism for meaning to go seriously wrong. And it's a tragic tale of humanity spiraling down. The worst thing I think about this television series is that there seems to be no redemption. There's no God working out his purposes with a people of faith. It's just all bleak. Well, the story of Ruth starts with a woman called Naomi, and she suffers similar kinds of misfortune to Walter White in Breaking Bad. She lives in a time of economic hardship. The Epaphrathites were normally quite a well-to-do clan, and Bethlehem was normally a fertile region. It actually meant house of bread. But there was a famine. We don't know whether that was caused by the weather or perhaps by the disruption to food production caused by conflict. And there was a lot of conflict at the time of the judges, mainly due to the Israelites worshipping idols and then becoming weak spiritually and morally, and their enemies oppressed them and invaded and ravaged their land. And so food shortages were common. And Elimelech decides that they have better prospects in Moab, of all places, a land, a pagan land, where the god Chemosh was worshipped, who demanded child sacrifice. But Naomi presumably just had to go along with Elimelech's idea of emigrating for a while. And they leave with their two sons, Mahlon and Chilion. But tragedy strikes. Within 10 years, both Elimelech and both the sons, Mahlon and Chilion, die, leaving Naomi as a migrant widow in a foreign land. And without descendants, having descendants was so important in those days because people didn't really have a belief in the resurrection. Certainly it was, if they had some kind of hope, it was a vague kind of hope. But for most people, including the Israelites, what made their life significant was having descendants who would carry on their name. And so without descendants, she would have seen her life as sad and pointless. And she changes her name. She tells people she doesn't want to be known as Naomi anymore, which means pleasant. She wants to be known as Mara, which means bitter. Life seems to have reduced her to being a dried up, bitter old woman. So it might be thought that for Naomi, her life was just devoid of the presence and the blessing of God. God seems to be so much a stranger to Naomi that it appears that he just doesn't show up at all. He's just not there. However, this book of Ruth, named after her daughter-in-law, is a lovely story. Do read it in its entirety, maybe when you get home. We haven't read it through this evening, but it probably takes about 15-20 minutes, and I think to get the full benefit of it, you need to read it in one go, really. So do read all four chapters sometime in the coming few days. As I said, the book is really about the steady providence of God, his presence under the surface, if you like. It appears that, you know, he's not showing up and Naomi's life is just terrible. But all the time, God is working his sovereign purposes out for his people. In the final chapter, chapter 4, Ruth is revealed to be the great-grandmother of King David, and therefore Naomi is the great-great-grandmother. Naomi has her fortunes restored, her property, a field that belonged to her dead husband that was probably heavily mortgaged, is redeemed by a kinsman redeemer called Boaz. And she receives a legacy that is described by all her Bethlehem friends as better than if she had borne 7 sons. Now, that was really saying something in those days. It was a way of saying that her life actually could not be more blessed, could not be more significant, that God could not have poured out his blessing on her in any greater way. She ends her days in peace and contentment. And as I say, Ruth has this important place in the genealogy of David, and obviously Jesus was born of David's line as well. Now, given the crucial link these characters play in the genealogy of David and Jesus, you might have thought that God might have made his presence known in this story, and perhaps in more dramatic and in interventionist ways. But for the most part in this story, there's not spectacular miracles, but actually God is there, hidden behind the scenes, working out his loving purposes, I think, in four main ways. And these four are, firstly, his faithfulness to Israel, his steadfast love. Secondly, the just and compassionate laws God gave to his people, which blessed people for generation upon generation, really. Thirdly, his providential ordering of events, his timing. And fourthly, the hope that godly character in human beings engenders. So let's consider these four ways in which God was working. Even when he was such a stranger to Naomi, it appeared he was not showing up at all. So first, there's God's faithfulness to his people Israel. This was a time, as I said, of great unfaithfulness on the part of Israel. They didn't have a king. Everyone did what was right in their own eyes. People turned away from the living God to worship Baal and Ashtoreth, the god and goddess of fertility that the Canaanites had worshipped. And shrine prostitution was a way of worshipping these deities. It was believed that by visiting shrine prostitutes, Israeli farmers would sort of remind Baal and Ashtoreth that they had to sort of copulate in order to make the land fruitful and to bear crops. And so you can imagine, with this sort of debased religion, the people were far away from God spiritually and morally, and in their weakened and depraved states, they were easy prey for the hostile nations to oppress and invade them. And so they cried out to God time and again for him to deliver them, and God raised up people who were called judges, like Gideon, to deliver them. Samson and Jephthah and Deborah. But whenever their situation improved, whenever God gave them relief from their enemies, people then got complacent and materialistic, and they went back to worshipping the Baals, and they fell back, and the wretched cycle just repeated itself again. So, as I said, it could well have been as a result of their unfaithfulness in the first place that they were suffering this famine, and when things improved, when Naomi heard that the famine was over in Bethlehem, it says that she heard that God had once again come to the aid of his people. So here was God present in the sovereign protection of his people despite their unfaithfulness to him. The second way in which I think God is present in this story is the continuing effect of the way he'd already revealed himself through the law, through the Torah. the law of Israel. You see, the decrees given through Moses were often decrees that taught the Israelites to show justice and compassion and mercy to those who were vulnerable. Widows, orphans, foreigners, aliens. And God had said to them, you know what it's like to be slaves and aliens in a strange land. You were oppressed in Egypt, and therefore you should treat the foreigner among you with compassion. And they should care for widows. And Ruth was both a foreigner and a widow, so she was particularly vulnerable. Naomi's daughter-in-law. And God's law provided that when fields were harvested, the landowners, farm workers, were not to go over the fields twice to remove every stalk of grain, but they were to leave behind what they didn't reap the first time, so that the poor, the widows, and the foreigner might glean the leftovers. And this law provided a means by which the poor could support themselves, to have enough food and to have the dignity of work as well. It wasn't a simple handout. They had to work, but there was the work for them to do, and there was no waste either. So Ruth benefited from this law, which encouraged her. I imagine she on arrival in Israel, perhaps Naomi told her about this law, or perhaps she just heard about it and said to Naomi, well, let me go out and glean. Now, sadly, this law was not always upheld as it should have been, because Israel wasn't behaving as it always should have been. And often, vulnerable women were molested. And it's clear from reading the rest of the story that Boaz, who was a good and kind man, said, look, stay in my field, don't go anywhere else, because you might be molested. And Ruth's mother-in-law Naomi as well said the same thing. But the fact that there was this law there at all gave a measure of provision to people who would otherwise be completely destitute, and other nations didn't have such laws. So that was the second way in which God is present. Thirdly, God's present in this story through his providential ordering of events. Naomi returned with Ruth from Moab, arriving in Bethlehem, as it says, as the barley harvest was beginning. And Ruth goes to glean in a field, and verse 3 of chapter 2 says, as it turned out, she found herself working in a field belonging to Boaz, who was from Elimelech's clan. He was a relative of her late father-in-law. Now, an unbeliever would say, well, that was a lucky break. Ruth just happened to go into a field owned by a respective relative of Naomi's dead husband. But those who believe in God's providence, his sovereign working, believe it was no mere random or freak coincidence. It was a God incidence. God was working out his purposes. I hope you don't find this story irreverent. It's not meant to be. Jesus and Moses are playing a round of golf in heaven. Part of a threesome, in fact. Moses teed off first, and he hit his shot straight towards the water hazard. But just as the ball was about to land in the water, Moses lifted up his golf club and the water parted, allowing the ball to bounce through on dry land and onto the fairway. Then it was Jesus' turn. He teed off in the same direction, a long straight drive towards the water. But instead of sinking into the water, it floated on the surface. And then Jesus went over and walked on the water to where the ball was, and took his second shot, which landed nicely on the green, ready for a possible birdie. And then the third player drove off the tee, and this player sliced his drive over towards a large tree, and the golf ball bounced off the tree, landed on a water lily in a ditch. A frog then came up and held the ball in its mouth, and suddenly an eagle swooped down and carried off the frog. And the eagle's talons then squeezed the frog, and the ball popped out of its mouth and onto the green, bounced once, bounced twice, and then meandered its way into the hole for a hole in one. And Moses turned to Jesus and said, "I hate playing golf with your dad." But it may seem that as God's people, we're sometimes just sort of thrown about by the twists and the turns of fate. But no, God is sovereign. He's with us in the fire and the flood. He's working his purposes out for those who love him and accord according to his purpose. Even what the enemy means for bad, he turns it for our good. And works his purposes out in order to bring us home. So that's the third thing. Firstly, his faithfulness to Israel. Secondly, his laws of justice and compassion. Thirdly, his providential ordering of events. And fourthly and finally, we see the hand of God in this story bringing hope through the character of the people who believe in him and who choose to put their trust in him. So let's consider Naomi first. Although she's understandably grief-stricken and in many ways a broken woman, she does actually still hold on to her faith in the God of Israel. She is certainly upset with God. She's probably even angry with God. She certainly believes that it is the Lord who has made her life bitter and brought the misfortune on her. When she tells people to call her Mara instead of Naomi, she says, "The Lord has afflicted me. The Almighty has brought misfortune upon me." Earlier on in chapter 1, in verse 13, she says, "The Lord's hand has gone out against me." But actually, those who are upset with God and attribute their circumstances to God's will are actually closer to him than those who see their situation as simply bad luck and God as just uninvolved. It's the people who turn to God in agonized prayer and who are upset and want answers from God that are closer to him than those who just think, well, that's the hand of fate, or that's, you know, these are the cards that I happen to have randomly dealt to me. One of the children in Midweek Connection recently asked Kate, our children and families worker, and they had a wonderful time of discussion with these children, she told me. And one of the children asked her if it was okay to get upset and angry with God when she didn't feel her prayers were being answered. Well, expressing our pain and frustration to God is actually something only someone who really believes in him can do. It doesn't make sense otherwise. It's only if we believe in God and we believe that actually things should not be as they are, things should be better. And it's only if we believe that somewhere in God's heart there is a love for us and a concern for us that we would speak to him and plead with him. And God, I think, would much rather we were upset with him in prayer than we did not pray at all. So I think Naomi held on to her faith in God, and she certainly attributed to God the gratitude when things did start going right. So, you know, I've already mentioned about her hearing that God had come to the aid of his people. Later in chapter 2, when her daughter-in-law Ruth is looked after by Boaz, she bursts forth with a prayer for his blessing, and she acknowledges that God has not stopped showing kindness, not only to her and Ruth, but even to her dead husband and sons through the provision of the kinsman redeemer Boaz. And I think that we can see good character in Naomi. Where it says that when she heard that the famine had finished, she and her daughter-in-laws prepared for them to go to Bethlehem. And they actually, you know, they packed up, they actually set out on the road back to Judah. But then it seems that Naomi had a pang of conscience, I think. It seems like she suddenly realizes that she might be being a bit selfish. And she says to Orpah and Ruth, "No, actually, this is going to be no good for you. No one's going to be interested in marrying you back in Israel. The only thing would be if I had children, sons to marry, and that's not going to happen. So go back to your mum and you know, find husbands from your own people. You've got a much better chance if you do that." Now, I mean, you could say, well, she wasn't perhaps fully trusting that God might provide for them in Israel, but she was actually thinking of others rather than herself. And they, both Orpah and Ruth, said, no, we want to come with you. I mean, Naomi must have been an attractive person for them to say, no, we want to stick with you. But eventually Orpah kisses her goodbye, but Ruth is showing none of it. And I think it shows the effect of Naomi's faith and character on Ruth. Ruth was a Moabitess, daughter of a pagan nation, but I think she saw something in Naomi and her holding on to God, maybe, even through all this disaster. Something that was attractive. And she says, no, I want to be with you. Your people will be my people. Your God will be my God. And so she clung to her. And she invokes the name of the Lord in a solemn oath of faithfulness. Till death us do part, she said. When I preached at one of my brother's weddings, they chose the story of Ruth and that wonderful statement of where you go, I will go, may nothing separate me from you other than death. Even though Naomi has been taken out of the promised land and with all its spiritual corruption, and even despite all that's happened to her, the faith in which Naomi has been nurtured is real enough for a pagan woman like Ruth to see the true God in her. Next, let's consider Boaz. Once back in Israel, Boaz is the man in whose field Ruth goes to glean. Now, Boaz is a man of faith. He's a good employer. We get that from chapter 2, where he greets the harvest workers by saying, "The Lord be with you," and they all respond, "The Lord bless you." So, I mean, that's significant because Boaz is actually saying he wants his workers to know the presence of God in their work. He cares for them, and they in turn want God to bless Boaz, and they want to be productive and helpful. So that's a good sign that Ruth has found a field belonging to a good man. And Boaz seeks to fulfill the law of the Lord about the way you treat the foreigner and the widow by protecting Ruth. Really not only ensuring her protection from being molested, but, you know, going beyond the law's requirements in providing for her. And you see, he recognizes what a woman of noble character she is, the way she's shown her loyalty to her mother-in-law and chosen to seek protection under the wings of the God of Israel. You know, and it's like he wants to witness it. You know, he wants to be a good witness. He wants her to experience God's blessing and protection. Wouldn't it be terrible if a foreign woman came to Israel and instead of being looked after was molested and taken advantage of by the people who are supposed to be God's people? And later in the story, when Ruth obeys Naomi's instructions to make herself even more vulnerable in front of Boaz, in approaching him in the customary way to seek a particular kind of marriage, a kinsman redeemer marriage. He marvels at her kindness. Now, I used to think that he was sort of being a bit flattered that she wasn't going after the younger men, and he was saying, oh, you know, it's really nice of you to be interested in me. Actually, I don't think that's what he means. What he means is that she is willing to show, she's showing great kindness to Naomi and to her dead father-in-law and dead husband, because she is willing to honour this custom of the Levirate marriage, where she marries a close relative of her deceased husband in order to bear children who will be considered children of the dead man, to carry on his line. And Boaz is saying, wow, you know, you haven't, you know, you're a foreigner, you're poor, but you're an attractive woman. You could have gone after the younger men, rich or poor, but you've actually chosen to show kindness to your mother-in-law and your dead husbands, your dead husband and father-in-law. She just goes even further higher in his estimation. I think he does fall in love with her. And in a sinful world, really, where even, as we know, aid workers, people who are supposed to be looking after the poor and the vulnerable, exploit women sexually, Boaz treats Ruth with the utmost purity and honour. He calls her a foreigner. He calls her a daughter, my daughter. In other words, I want to protect you and make your life good. He considers himself fortunate to marry a woman of such character, even though his firstborn son by her, when they got married, would be considered to be of the line of another man, Elimelech and Kilion. But in his integrity, he it would have been so easy for him to take advantage of Ruth on the threshing floor and have his way with her, and then not got married and not gone to all the trouble of his son having to be considered belonging to another line, and him having to redeem the property belonging to Naomi out of his own money, all of this. And his character is such that he produces great hope for Naomi and Ruth. And he's so full of integrity, he even knows that there's actually someone else who is a closer kinsman to Naomi, and they have first dibs on the purchasing the property. And you have to read chapter 4 to work out what he does about that. Having fallen in love with Ruth, he really doesn't want someone else marrying her. So he's rather clever and shrewd, but very honest as well. He sorts it all out in the final chapter. And Boaz is a kind of type, that's a theological term, meaning a foreshadower. So he's a type of Christ, really. Christ is our ultimate sort of redeemer, kinsman redeemer. Christ is the perfect example of purity and redemptive power. But Boaz is a type of Christ. The Christ in us, always the hope of glory in our hearts. And it was really the character of Boaz that meant that this redemption scenario could take place. And if Boaz is a type of Christ, then Ruth is a type, a foreshadowing of the faithful church, the bride of Christ. She responded in loyalty and faith to the God of Israel, is represented to her by Naomi, at a time when much of Israel was faithless. And she, as a foreigner, symbolizes all those who come from far away, you know, child-sacrificing pagan nation, draw nearing to God through faith and humbly receiving his love and salvation. No wonder the book is named after Ruth. So throughout this story, God, the stranger, the one who appears not to show up, actually has been there all the time, working out his wonderful purposes through his faithful love for Israel, his laws of goodness and mercy, his providential timing, and the character of those who love him and approach him in faith. Amen.